Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Foreclosures have come back with a vengeance. That's how one housing industry analyst put today's news. New numbers show that there were 48% more foreclosures this March than last, as lenders resume repossessions after a temporary moratorium to digest Barack Obama's $75 billion rescue plan. Rebecca Christie covers the Treasury Department for Bloomberg News. Rebecca, now that the Obama plan is in the process of being implemented and lenders understand how it's going to work, we understand those lenders are going after the homes they know won't qualify. Which homes are those?
Well, some homeowners won't be able to benefit from this plan if, for example, they don't have a job and aren't able to make any mortgage payments at all, or if they have a mortgage that contractually is not allowed to be changed. Those are some of the bigger groups. The plan is mostly aimed at families that live in their home that maybe could make a mortgage payment but can't make a mortgage payment that's as big as the one they've got right now.
Right. We understand also not qualifying under the plan, vacant homes?
Well, there has to be somebody living in the home making
right.
a payment.
Right. And second homes and homes owned by speculators, they will not qualify. So if those mortgages are in trouble, lenders are now going after them. So this spike in foreclosures we're having is, in effect, a sort of backlog.
Analysts are saying that this comes from the end of a moratorium on foreclosures that many of the lenders had before. So there are a lot of cases moving forward now.
Right. Well, the plan also includes big financial incentives for lenders to take on some of these mortgages. Six banks signed up in advance. What are the incentives they'll be getting?
The banks have signed up through their servicing arms, and the servicers are sort of middlemen between the person living in the home and the person who makes money off the loan. So the person living in the home wants to make their mortgage payment and stay living in their home, and they'd like to see that payment come down. The person who invests in the loan just wants to make sure that they get a steady payment every month from all of the mortgages they have, not just one particular. So the services are in the middle working with the homeowners and the investors, and they're going to get some money from the government and also from possibly Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to help make up the difference between the lower payment and what the investors were expecting.
So Wells Fargo or Saxon Mortgage Services, these are some of the banks that have stepped forward. They may take on some loans. They may lose some money in doing that, but they'll get some money from the government to make it up.
Right. Saxon is the servicing arm of Morgan Stanley, and Wells Fargo, of course, is its own servicing arm. And the idea is that if they come up with a lower payment for the homeowner, and if the homeowner is able to stay in their home because of this lower payment, then after 3 months, the homeowner is making the new payment, staying in the home, and not in trouble, then they'll get some money from the government to help make up the difference between the old higher payment and the lower payment so that the investor isn't hurt as much.
Well, the fact is that according to the latest data, even when people are able to refinance, more than half of them aren't getting a meaningful reduction in their mortgages because of how banks have been doing the refinancing. So, I mean, is the hope that this financial incentive will help banks to make that decision?
Help banks is exactly right. This program is voluntary, but the Obama administration is very much trying to get a larger and more meaningful reduction in people's payments, and they're hoping that the deeper cuts will come because of this sort of sweetening of the pot that they're doing with the government rescue money.
Well, and what's the expectation? That's hope, but what's the expectation that this new plan will work? Because its predecessor, which was the Homeowners Act, which was passed last year under the Bush administration, which made as much as $300 billion available to help people refinance their homes. We're hearing in a report on Morning Edition this morning, which we'll link you to at our website, by the way, it's just extraordinary, that that program helped exactly one person in the last 6 months. One person.
There have been a lot of programs out there, all of them trying some combination of government encouragement and backing and voluntary participation. The hope is that now that the government is actually putting up some money and trying to reach a broad segment of loans, that they can reach more people. There is a lot of skepticism on Wall Street about this program, about whether or not investors will trust it, whether loans will be able to be modified, whether homeowners, let's say they go through all the loops, whether they'll be able to make the new lower payments, how that's really going to work. And the servicers are worried about being sued for making the changes.
Sued by the investors who own the loans.
That's certainly a worry that some people have expressed.
Right. And by the way, we mentioned the Bush-era plan that's only helped one person. Congress is trying to amend that plan to get that money moving to homeowners. That's Rebecca Christie. She covers the Treasury Department for Bloomberg News. Rebecca, thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
Breastfeeding has long been the third rail of motherhood. Here in Massachusetts, women who breastfed in public could be prosecuted for indecent exposure or lewd conduct before a new law passed this month promoting breastfeeding. Breastfeeding was once out, now it's in. For years, women have been told that breast is best, that breastfeeding a child will lead to fewer ear infections, allergies, stomach problems, and lower rates of obesity, diabetes, and heart disease. But one journalist who is a breastfeeding mom wonders if breastfeeding might be the new vacuum cleaner. That is, something that's presented as better for women, but in reality is a tool of domestic oppression that ties them down. Hannah Rosen is breastfeeding her third child, but with less fervor than the first two, and she writes that the insistent cheerleading from people she calls breastfeeding fascists has begun to grate. Her article in The Atlantic magazine has set the online mom circles abuzz, and I can see the fingers of La Leche League members poised above keyboards writing us even as we speak. Hannah Rosen joins us from the Atlantic XM Media Studios in Washington, D.C. Hannah, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, and I know you've been hearing from people. La Leche is the organization devoted to breastfeeding. What are you hearing from them? And I guess from people across the board.
I have had exactly two kinds of reactions. In my email inbox are hundreds of emails from grateful moms, and I start there because it makes me feel better. But, you know, mothers who say, thank you, I'm glad to hear a different voice. I had this trouble, I had that trouble. And then I've had a whole other set of emails, which you can expect from people who are furious and who are devoted to breastfeeding and the science behind breastfeeding and think I have done a great disservice to infant health.
And those have been the typical responses to this discussion for, you know, a couple decades now. But you trace back how we got to where we are in the late 19th century. Formula was all the rage as a way to fight infant mortality. But by the 50s, women began to rebel against a lot of thinking about child rearing. And the Catholic moms in Chicago who rebelled against formula called themselves La Leche League. Now, wasn't that at that time a good and liberating thing?
Absolutely. I mean, at the time when women were having babies, the doctor would basically dictate. They would immediately inject you with hormones.
Which did what? Stopped the milk from coming?
They were hormones that stopped the milk from coming instantly. And my mother tells me about them. And, you know, who knows how women felt about them. But it was generally then, I'm sure, for modesty reasons and for sort of patriarchal doctor reasons. And a lot of things were mixed in there. They, you know, just convinced women that that was the best thing to do. And it's very good that somebody fought against that because, you know, I wouldn't want my doctor telling me absolutely I had to do one thing or another thing.
Right. And for people who haven't been through this, you know, once your body, after you've had a child, gets going, it's a raging machine. It's going to produce milk. It sort of drives the whole discussion.
Yeah, I mean, breastfeeding is a very tricky thing. You know, if you are breastfeeding, you are breastfeeding. I mean, it's something that's happening all day, all the time. And for many women, it's very difficult in the beginning. Now, for me, it wasn't. I did not have any problems at all. It was all quite smooth. It's just that it's really sort of all-day job.
Well, and there's also something called breastfeeding-induced maternal nirvana. And you experienced that. You breastfed your first two children.
I think that I still love to breastfeed, and this will not be heard by anyone who's read my article and particularly the headline, nor will they care. I guess that the point I'm trying to make is a little subtler point, which is that I don't want to be tricked into believing that the evidence for breastfeeding is better than it is, nor do I want to be told I absolutely have to breastfeed, nor do I want to be told that formula is poison, because none of those things are true. And so I just felt with my third child, I guess, I finally had the confidence to kind of look over all the evidence and think about this seriously and say, well, okay, I actually do like to breastfeed. But with a third child, I've also got two other children. I've got a husband I'd like to talk to. I'm in the middle of starting a website. I write stories. I've just got a lot going on, you know? And so you can't pretend that breastfeeding is the absolutely most important thing. This sign of whether I'm a good mother or not, and more important than anything else I might do for my children, which is how breastfeeding is presented. And I might say that this is only in our sort of upper middle class culture. There's a whole different set of issues that apply if you're poorer, if you live in a third world country. It's really a different set of issues, and people have criticized me about that, and that's legitimate. But I'm talking about the sort of middle class mothers like myself who decided that breastfeeding is the gold standard of mothering.
Well, and just want to stop there for a second, because you do point out that this is an argument that many upper middle class women have the luxury of having. There are, blue collar working women on an assembly line. For them, they can't even consider this because there's nowhere for them to go. There's no privacy. You have to pump during the day. They can't get as much time off. It's not as much of an issue.
And I guess people fail to realize, yes, that's absolutely true, that breastfeeding is a, particular vision of mothering in which the mother is central to everything. There's lots of cultures in which many people help to raise the baby, and it's just not realistic to breastfeed. And yes, certainly for women who have to work, and particularly in this economy, it feels to me almost cruel to tell them that they absolutely have to breastfeed and to make them feel bad because they can't do it. I mean, there's lots of things that go into being a good mother, and, breastfeeding is one of them.
Well, let's talk about when your thinking changed. Again, you talked about having a third child and suddenly you don't have the time that you had before. But you also happened to see an article from 2001 in the Journal of American Medical Association as you were half naked nursing one of your children.
Yeah. I mean, the way this really started was that I had a very close friend who also had a third child, and she is a doctor, and she had breast cancer right after her third child was born. And she is a doctor, I might point out. And she was kind of panicked about this idea that she couldn't breastfeed her baby. And she started looking through the literature. And that's when it first clicked to me. It's like, wow, you've got a woman who knows the evidence really well, who's basically in personality a skeptic, who just had breast cancer diagnosed, and even she feels incredibly guilty about not being able to breastfeed her child. And so that was what was in the back of my mind when I had this third child, and I suddenly felt this overload of things I have to do. So I was kind of, in the right place to see this article that I saw on a pediatrician's desk, which talked about the very mixed results about breastfeeding and obesity. Now, since then, I started to look at all the evidence, and there's lots of mixed results about allergies, about asthma, even about mother-infant bonding. I mean, the scientific literature really doesn't look like the popular literature, which gives you this idea, here's the list, here's everything breastfeeding does for your baby, case closed. I mean, the scientific literature doesn't support a conclusion like that. Maybe it will someday if they find the, way to do fabulous research, but there has been really, really good research done to date, and it doesn't support the conclusions.
Well, one of the conclusions, for instance, one of the traditional thinkings was that breast milk contained antibodies from the mom that get absorbed by the baby.
That is a much more complicated picture than we have been led to believe. In most mammals, all of the antibodies that are necessary for the survival of the baby are from the breast milk. In humans, most of the antibodies that are necessary come from the placenta. And then what breast milk does is add sort of an extra layer of antibodies. And they do have some protective effect. I think there's no question about that. There's excellent research showing, for example, that breastfeeding helps prevent gastrointestinal infections. So you should weigh that. If you're deciding whether to breastfeed or not, don't say to yourself, oh, it's all just bogus. It's not all bogus. There's some evidence that it does help prevent, it does give you a little bit of protection against certain things. Now, as a mom, you can put that in one column, and then you can put all the 100 other things you're worried about in another column and make your decision.
That's Hannah Rosen. She's written a provocative article about breastfeeding for The Atlantic. She'll be back in a minute. We want to ask about what she says is a disparity between popular literature and medical literature when it comes to breastfeeding. Also, later today, we're going to speak to a banker in Michigan about how he's adapting centuries-old concepts of banking to fit his Muslim customers' needs. For instance, there's no interest rates on loans. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to Here and Now. We've been talking about the pros and cons of breastfeeding with Hannah Rosen. She's a contributing editor for The Atlantic, and she's written a provocative article entitled The Case Against Breastfeeding. She is breastfeeding her third child, but less enthusiastically than her first two. And Hannah, from what we've been hearing, it sounds that after looking at all the evidence, you've concluded that breastfeeding does have a few more health benefits for children, but new moms shouldn't do it if they're being made crazy physically trying to do it, because they can pass that tension on to their children.
Yeah, or if you work, or if you can't do it, if you just don't want to do it. I mean, there's 100 reasons. You know, there's very good reasons to breastfeed, and for many women, there's also very good reasons not to breastfeed. And we talk about, when we talk about breastfeeding like it's this liquid vaccine, you can't but feel like a horrible mother if you choose not to breastfeed. I happen to really like breastfeeding. Other people can't stand breastfeeding. You know, or for example, the situation of many women that I know where they're pumping madly. Now, pumping, you know, I wish the thing had never been invented. It's like, you know, pumping kind of takes away a lot of the lovely benefits of breastfeeding. You know, they don't know if the benefits of breastfeeding come from that sort of cuddliness you have with your child, like the intelligence benefits, that time spent, or the milk itself. Now, we've put so much emphasis on the milk itself and its fabulous properties that people end up kind of pumping because they can't or don't want to breastfeed, and then feeding that pump milk to their baby. And that seems to me like a crazy system.
Especially if, in fact, the benefits aren't in the milk. But you spoke to a researcher who dismissed the benefits of the milk itself and said that the benefits of breastfeeding could actually just be the result of moms interacting with babies, as you mentioned, rather than the milk. For many people, that's the point, the most worthwhile point. It's the connection.
Yes, and by the way, he doesn't dismiss. He thinks both are true, and he really doesn't know, and he's very honest, and that's why I appreciate him. And yes, it could be either one. It could be just from the cuddling and the physical skin-to-skin contact, and that's a lovely thing, or it could be from the milk itself, and nobody really knows. And anyway, even if it is from the cuddling, how would you quantify that? Could you really say that that leads to 3 to 5 IQ points? I mean, that's basically what the culture's been telling us, and I think we're a long way from knowing that for sure.
Well, and as you said, what good does that do the mother who really can't because her work obligations, maybe she's raising the children alone. And again, we come back to a conclusion in an article in the 1984 issue of Pediatrics that the studies of breastfeeding do not support making a mother feel that she is doing psychological harm to her child if she's unable or unwilling to do it.
You know, it's funny. I never found a quote that stark from a study done after 1984. And I think that has something to do with the way we write articles now and that they're more niche and kind of nuanced. But I also think it has to do with the fact that that became a taboo thing to say.
Well, I was going to say, you found that the medical literature was completely different from the popular culture literature.
Yes, it is very mixed. You have, first of all, studies of wildly varying quality, very few that are really good studies, and they conclude very mixed things about allergies, about asthma, about IQ. They conclude pretty uniform things about gastrointestinal infections. That's the one thing in which there's a real consensus. There's lots of interesting research being done on intelligence, you know, but again, how do you quantify intelligence? You know, are we at the place where we can say things for sure? No. I mean, the popular literature has stepped sort of way ahead of what the science proves.
Well, and this brings us to another aspect of your article. I can see readers being sympathetic with the idea that, you know, by the third child, you can't do it full time, and mixing in a little formula isn't going to, you know, completely derail that child. But then you get to a broader conversation about the role that men and women play and how people of your age, of your generation, were told that co-parenting was going to be an attainable goal. But that if the mother is breastfeeding, it sort of sets up a relationship, you know, it sort of trickles down from there, that the mother becomes the center of the child's life in a way a father just can't.
Yes, and I think that that might come as a shock to women of my generation, especially new parents, that you have been raised to, you know, think about this idea of equal parenting, co-parenting, which happens in many cases. I have a great husband who does a huge amount of work and taking care of the kids and cooking and all that. He's great. But, you know, it is set up initially, I'm the one who has the 6-month maternity leave because I am breastfeeding and I'm breastfeeding around the clock. And essentially that first baby is like my baby. I'm providing the baby's sustenance. You know, I am the very food for the baby. And so you really, equality is not possible in that situation.
Well, and you also write that one side effect of that is that you looked around and saw many of the women that you knew from college who had been on a fast track and they were derailed because they were breastfeeding?
No, I mean, you know, that's where I think you can't draw the line from A to B to C, and I'm kind of musing a little bit there. Mm-hmm. But there is a sense in which, I guess the better way to put it was that there, you know, feminism is a topic that's kind of closed in the way that we used to talk about it in the 70s. Nobody really talks about feminism. Nobody so much talks about the waves anymore. We feel that we're in a kind of post-feminist age, and maybe that's just another way of saying that there's a lot of issues that aren't resolved. unsolved and unexplored. And I'm not saying they need to be fixed. I'm not sure how you get around this problem. A lot of this is genetic. A lot of this has to do with how women feel about children and how women and men are built. Not all of it, but some of it. And so, but I still think there's just a lot of issues left to discuss that we've just kind of set aside.
Well, are you advocating, and I can't remember where I saw it, frankly, I can't remember if I saw it on a sitcom or in real life, but men were wearing these pouches that they could fill with breast milk so that they could breastfeed?
Wasn't that in Robert De Niro and the in-laws?
I don't know. I can't remember. But are you advocating that?
Ugh, that's just the worst thing ever. No. No, I don't really have any answers. I just have questions. If I had to rewrite my life, I would not do it any differently. I would not have missed out on that kind of dreamy 6 months of exclusive breastfeeding when I was a first-time mother that went on for, you know, I don't even remember, a couple, 2.5 years. I wouldn't have missed out on that. I loved it. It was special. I had no problems, you know? But I just, you know, I feel for these vulnerable mothers who hate it or don't want to do it, and they just made to feel like they're, you know, poisoning their children. It's just, I just felt like enough already.
That's Hannah Rosen. She's contributing editor to The Atlantic Magazine. We'll link you to her article and the response. Hannah, thanks so much for opening up this topic for us again.
Anytime. Thank you.
Okay, let's take a quick look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, lots of people run the Boston Marathon. It's coming up Monday. But why would you run your first barefoot?
There's a few reasons. I think the biggest one for me is achieving more of a natural form. We weren't born with shoes on our feet.
Ah, it makes me want to go out and sweep the course. That's tomorrow. Back after the news, Here and Now. Tomorrow, Swedish judges will decide the fate of four pirates, not the hijackers of the high seas, but internet pirates, who run the popular file-sharing site thepiratebay.org. It's a 5-year-old site which prosecutors claim illegally enables free downloads of copyright-protected files, including music, movies, and games, much to the chagrin of Hollywood and U.S. record companies. Oscar Schwartz has been covering the Pirate Bay trial for Wired.com. He's also covering the activist pirate community in Sweden. Oscar, start there. You're right, there's even a pirate political party, and this all came in response to Sweden's anti-piracy campaign.
That's right. There was an anti-piracy bureau formed a number of years ago. And as a response to that, an open culture activist youth community started called the Pirate Bureau. So they basically appropriated the word piracy and made it something positive. They thought it was good, the new digital society where you can share things. And then they started an experiment to educate people how to share files, and that became the Pirate Bay.
Yeah. Now, there's similar file-sharing sites, Napster, Grokster, Kazaa, but they've all been found illegal and been shut down. So tell us how the Pirate Bay works.
The difference is that they don't store any kind of copyrighted material. It's basically a community where people can find each other if they want to share material. And this is, of course, the defense of these accused so-called pirates. And the form of prosecution is that they are assisting others in committing copyright crime. In legal terms, it might be quite complicated and nitpicky. Yeah. But they are not accused of committing copyright crime themselves.
Well, in addition to the Swedish prosecutors, several Hollywood and music firms are also filing civil suits, Warner Brothers, MGM. And we understand all of these different suits and complaints will be decided by these Swedish judges tomorrow. But in the case of the civil suits asking for millions of dollars, does this group even have that money?
No, I mean, they have financed the site a little with advertising. It's not big money, not even according to the prosecutor. They have basically been sleeping on sofas and are, well, nerds.
Well, in fact, tell us about these guys. They're in their 20s, and they've been very colorful and very defiant.
That's right. They have become sort of celebrities and stars, and their defiance has, of course, made people quite impressed. And the fact is that legislation is not different in Sweden than from other European countries. Sometimes they say Sweden has looser copyright legislation, but that's not the case. The case is that these guys have never folded down their site, even though they have got all these threats of being sued and so on.
Well, in fact, they post the letters on their site from top lawyers. And in one case, when the lawyer for DreamWorks complained about them making the movie Shrek 2 available to users, the response was, go blank yourself. Is there a sense that they may be themselves, these pirates, walking the plank?
Well, I mean, they have had a lot of fun in the meantime, but I guess most people would not do what they have done because, yeah, they could be faced with debts for the rest of their lives and so on. But that has made them a cultural heroes also. So there is a big movement, and as you said, there is a party now, a Swedish pirate party, that might get into the EU parliament now.
So tomorrow the judges are expected to give their verdict, and it could go several ways. It might go to another European court to answer some questions that the defense wants answered. But what happens if these guys are let go? What does that mean for file sharing?
Well, if they're let go, of course, the judgment will be appealed. Everyone expects this case to go up to the Supreme Court of Sweden, which may take several years. But I think before the case has reached that, we will have new file-sharing protocols and ways to do this, like OneSwarm, which has been developed at the University of Washington in Seattle. It's a new anonymous file-sharing protocol. And, you know, there is a technological war between pirates and academicians, actually. These are researchers at an American university funded by the National Sound Foundation. So these wars will continue, and there are a lot of people, especially in Sweden now, that think that we must discuss the basic questions. What should copyright be in a digital society where people can transfer information in a very easy way? Maybe we have to change our view on that.
That's Oscar Schwartz, contributing writer for Wired.com, telling us about the PirateBay.org trial in Sweden. Oscar, thanks so much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And we'll be back in a quick bit here and now. When we hear about Sharia law, it's often in the context of harsh punishment of women in third world countries. But Sharia law is much broader than that, and it's playing an increasingly prominent role in Western countries. Last fall, Great Britain gave Sharia courts the power to rule on Muslim civil cases. And here in the U.S., Sharia-approved banking is gaining momentum. Now, under Sharia law, the paying or charging of interest is forbidden for observant Muslims, which makes it impossible for a devout family to buy a house unless they save up and pay cash. But some U.S. banks are starting to offer Muslim clients alternatives to traditional mortgages, alternatives that don't require interest payments. University Bank in Ann Arbor, Michigan, is in the forefront of this movement. The bank got involved when a Muslim man walked into the office of the bank president, an Italian and a Catholic, and asked why the bank wasn't serving the Muslim community. Well, within a few years, University Bank started rolling out its first Sharia-approved mortgage alternatives. Amjad Quadri is vice president at University Bank and a practicing Muslim. Amjad, welcome.
Thank you very much, Robin.
We should say at the outset, like all faiths, Muslims are not a monolith. But for those who are very observant and who practice Sharia law, why is interest, charging interest or receiving it, a problem?
Interest is a problem in the Islamic faith because people that have money, it's usually the rich. And in Islam, they want to keep the rich from getting richer without having to take any risk. The way interest conventionally is done in the United States is giving a loan, and if something happens, the person giving the loan, in this case the bank, have a guarantee that they'll get all their money back, and if it's not from the property, they can go after the assets. But in Islam, they really want to avoid that, so it's more of a business transaction. If you buy a property with someone and they fall into hardship, you can get the property back, but you can't go after their personal assets. So there's some risk being taken by the people that have money.
And there's also a sense just in general that the rich making more money off the poor is just not acceptable.
Exactly.
Right. So you've come up with these mortgage alternatives. There are many different kinds, but give us an overarching thought about how they work.
Basically, it's a rent-to-own concept, and in Islam, it's called ijara. And what we do is, if a Muslim family finds a home, we say, great, you found a home, and we will buy it. We will hold the home in a trust, and they'll make monthly payments. They'll start off with a good lump sum, equivalent to a down payment, and they'll make monthly payments, out of which there will be a payment that goes towards their actual buying back the home from us, and another portion that will go towards rent. And the amount that goes towards their balance to pay us back, it goes into an on account, something like a savings account. When they get to the original price that the home was bought for, then we'll go ahead and transfer the trust over to their name, the deed, and the home will be completely theirs.
So the rental money is, in effect, it plays the part of the interest, in effect.
Absolutely. the benefits in Islamic finance come at both ends. One is when the transaction is done, it's set in a way that is according to Islamic law. And the other advantage is when someone is in trouble. When someone is in trouble, if they have late payments, the conventional way to handle that is to take the payment amount that they're late with and increase it by a percentage. And a lot of times their principal ends up going up. What Islamic finance specifically says is that you cannot burden someone that's late or in some kind of financial trouble with a higher payment. So we specifically only have a $50 charge that we charge them anytime they're late. And the second advantage is in the rent-to-own model, we own the home until they've completely owned it from us. So in between, if they get into trouble, and we had a couple incidents where they have gotten into trouble and the home has sold for less, we've taken the loss on it and we don't go after them for their personal assets. So there's a non-recourse when it comes to that.
Well, now, why would a bank do that? Because we've seen tons of mortgages go bad recently. So why would you take that risk?
We're hoping that the market overall will give us returns that we can sustain it. More than that, I think it was specifically to fulfill the Muslim niche. We've found it to be beneficial. We know that the defaults when it comes to the Muslim market are a lot less than the conventional defaults. Like in Michigan, the defaults overall are close to about 7% or higher. And in our Islamic market, we see them to be less than 2%.
Well, so we understand that's a unique part of the Islamic faith as well.
It is. Muslims overall do not like the concept of being in debt. It's something that's frowned upon, and they try to pay things off as quickly as they can. And when they go into contracts, they like to make sure that they fulfill them.
Well, we understand that your bank also offers Sharia-approved savings accounts. Now, let me try to take a stab at this to see if I've got this. Let's say I want to buy a house through you using this rent-to-own model, and you also have another Muslim client who wants to open a savings account. So as you just said, you as the bank will go and buy the house that I want using bank money, but also money from this other Muslim client. So the other Muslim effectively owns a fraction of my house. And when I pay rent to you, the bank, a portion of that rent goes back to the other Muslim client. Not as interest, although it effectively is, but as a partial payment because, as I said, they also own part of the house. They're also part landlords. So have I got that right, that that's how they can sort of have a savings account?
Absolutely. And what we have is we have four savings products. We have our money market, and then we have our three CDs. And we give Muslims returns on them based on how well our home portfolio does. So our rent-to-own home portfolio, if we're getting an average of 6% back from, you know, our clients, then on our five-year CDs, some of our five-year CD holders were getting as high as about 5% back at one point. So over time, if we have no homes to rent out, like if there's no Muslim clients that want to buy, only Muslim clients that want to save, then they'll get 0% return to those months because we have nowhere to generate a profit
from. Right, and that would not happen in an interest-bearing account, so that makes it different there. But still, Amjad, is what's happening here, and it's sounding like it's wonderful for observant Muslims, but is it just a technicality? Is it sort of skirting language in a way?
You know, Robin, I thought that for a long time, but the more and more I've just understood my faith better over time, and especially when I went to do the annual pilgrimage, the Hajj, you know, there's certain rituals that you do in religion that you do them only because God said that this is why you have to do it. And I was with a very prominent scholar that went from the United States, you know, Dr. Omar Farouk Abdullah of Nowi Foundation. And I asked him, I'm like, why are we doing some of this stuff? And he's just like, you know what, some of this stuff you're doing just because. And I really found at that point, I was just like, you know, a lot of when it comes down to Islamic finance, why we pray five times a day, it's, you know, it's simply because this is what God has instructed us to do. And it might seem like, hey, yeah, you know, what's the difference? But when it comes to everything being on the good and all the payments being made on time, the numbers work out to be relatively the same. The means, how you get to it, is very different. But when you're in trouble, the difference really shows up because yeah, then it's a more just way of handling your clients and being fair with them.
Well, others have said that as well, that, you know, Islamic financing would have saved us from people with no credit and no jobs getting loans, or people getting the ARMs, the adjusted rates, where their interest rates shot through the roof. I mean, interest rates have sort of been at the core of some of the financial meltdown.
It has, but I think greater than the interest rate has been the fact that the no income, no asset verification, when you're letting people who only make $20,000 a year buy homes that are worth $500,000, it's just, that's what happened. I mean, we've heard examples over and over again. I think that's what's gotten us into more trouble than anything else. Right. And, you know, I'd like to think that Islamic financing is the solution for what has happened. But the problem is when there's a vast amount of capital to be invested and greed gets involved, I'm not sure if any type of law stops normal humans from making the mistakes that we do.
That's Amjad Qadri, Vice President of the University Bank in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Robin.
And just a reminder, you can always go to our website and download a podcast or click on Contact Us and get in touch. Just go to hereandnow.org. Back in a quick minute with acclaimed new writer Wells Tower, Here and Now. A guy wakes from a drunken binge covered with broken saltine crackers. His wife says, "I'm a happier person when I forget who you are." Marauding Vikings take one last pillage before settling down. A man lovingly stocks an aquarium with fish, then a friend puts in a slug which poisons them all. Short story writer Wells Tower heard that story from a bartender and made it his own. It's part of his new and his first short story collection. He's getting the kind of reviews a writer might sell his soul for, and many of his characters probably would as well. Take Bob. He gets drunk, loses his job, and rear-ends a lawyer.
Worst of all, he had tried to find relief from the unpleasantness by trysting with a lonely woman he'd met in traffic school. There had been no joy in it, just a 2-week spate of drab skirmishes in a basement apartment that smelled heavily of cat musk. Not long after the affair had run its course, Bob and his wife were driving into town when Vicky looked up and saw the phantom outline of a woman's footprint on the windshield over the glove box. She slipped her sandal off, saw that the print did not match her own, and told Bob that he was no longer welcome in their home.
The terrific new book is called Everything Ravaged, Everything Burned, and Wells Tower joins us in the studio. And Wells, your characters seem to be fumbling towards some redemption after some horrible event, but what they usually find is more humiliation. Who are these people?
I look at them, you know, not necessarily as the hard luck, desperate people that reviewers seem to identify them as. To me, they're just people who are looking for a bit of safe harbor in life, a way out of, you know, the hideousness of loss and the complications of trust and sometimes family in a few of the stories.
And in many American stories, they get that, and in yours, they don't get what they just don't get it. I mean, is there one happy ending? I'm trying to think.
I think in the Viking story, ultimately, it's a little bittersweet. Yeah, you may be right.
I may be, because let's talk about the Viking story. It's the last one in the book, and suddenly all of the stories are modern times, but suddenly we're thrust back to sort of a look at pillaging Vikings, but through a sort of Wall Street sensibility. These guys are like, you know, Wall Street traders, and they go out and rape and pillage and rape and pillage, but then they start families. Would you read the last paragraph of that story? It's a sleepless Viking ruminating at night.
Sure. After Pila and me had our little twins, and we put a family together, I got an understanding of how terrible love can be. You wish you hated those people, your wife and children, because you know the things the world will do to them, because you have done some of those things yourself. It's crazy-making, yet you cling to them with everything and close your eyes against the rest of it. But still, you wake up late at night and lie there listening for the creak and splash of oars, the clank of steel, the sounds of men rowing towards your home.
And I read those last words in your book and I think, wow, we really haven't come that far from the Vikings, have we?
I think with that story, I don't know if I was trying to make any sort of big point with that ending. I think that after all of the hideousness of the story, I myself was yearning for some kind of redemption at the end. And so I sort of went for what feels to me like kind of a soaringly sentimental ending.
Well, yeah, because he is embracing family, but it's still worried about the Vikings at the door. And to me, it threw me back to The old and new husbands warily circling each other, the brothers warily circling each other in another story. I mean, just this far away from the Vikings who are going to rip your lungs out, you know?
Sure.
I read in one of the many articles about you recently that, you know, part of what we're hearing in these stories is things that you've heard people say. Is that what you're picking up from people?
The collections are real pastiche. I mean, of, you know, some stuff from my own life, but really very little. A lot, you know, it's anecdotes from friends or, you know, there are moments or bits of dialogue and scenes and incidents that I picked up, you know, in the last decade doing magazine journalism.
Give me an example.
Well, the carnival story was a great debt to my first sort of major piece of magazine journalism where I pitched a story to the Washington Post magazine where I was going to go and get a job in a traveling carnival. The idea was that I was going to penetrate all of these stereotypes that we have about carnival workers, that they're scary criminals, and I was going to show that it was really this sort of family of dispossessed people who really were very decent, nice folks. Of course, once I got the job, I then found out that every terrible thing that we've heard about carnival workers is true.
At least in the, we'll say, in the carnival you were at, just
In the carnival, I was at, right, exactly. But yeah, I didn't meet a soul who hadn't done extensive prison time for something awful. But anyway, that was a story where there was just so much left on the cutting room floor that I couldn't help but sweep it up and cobble it together into a piece of fiction.
Right, and so we have, as we said, at a carnival where one of the storylines is a young boy is molested, and the guy gets completely away with it. Where the readers are the only one who knows that he did it. And he not only gets away with it, but he's having great times on the rides at the carnival. That's pretty cynical.
I guess I'm very wary of putting heroics into my stories, that I really don't like good guys, and I really don't like bad guys either. With each of these characters, I sort of want there to be something redemptive and also something believably ugly.
And what about how really men come off? I can think of a child who's now forced to live with his mean stepfather who humiliates his father in front of him. And then there's another father asked to drive the new stepdad, you know, down the coast of California, I think it is. And he gets into a humiliating barroom brawl. You know, a lot of guys seem down on the, not just down on their luck, but down on the floor looking up. There's all these men who seem to have this undeserved humiliation.
It's funny. I don't exactly know where that came from. I can't say that I've led a life rich in violence or humiliation. I think that maybe some of it owes a debt to a kind of Southern Gothic tradition, you know, that Flannery O'Connor is... you know, she was a master at you know, both violence and terrible humiliation. And when you're humiliated, it's one of these things that immediately gets banked in your long-term memory. And, you know, unlike moments of joy or anger, you know, I feel like we can all look back at things that might have happened 15 or 20 years ago, moments in which we were humiliated, and be able to recall them with an incredible amount of pain and vitality as though we're reliving them right now.
So it can propel a character through a storyline.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. And I think that with these stories, too, I was really trying to find moments in which these people's lives were going to pivot in some big way, you know, moments that would at least make it into the long-term memory of these characters, the stories they'd be telling 15, 20 years down the line. And I think that humiliation is somehow the soul of part of that.
Well, that's Wells Tower. His book of short stories is called Everything Ravaged, Everything Burned. It's his first, and we look forward to the next. Wells, thanks so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.